Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You've heard us say it before. The 2020 presidential election was met with record voter turnout. Several states across the country made it easier for Americans to cast their vote amid the deadly coronavirus pandemic.
The entire system of elections in the United States is, for the most part, set around the whole construct of having all the foxes guard the hen house. Because if all the foxes are guarding the hen house, then they're not going to let some other fox go grab those eggs. And so understand there's a context to elections that in most cases, in most places, works very well because you've got strong partisans from both sides or multiple sides.
Welcome to Dead Men Don't Vote.
So we're here to ensure the right to vote will be preserved.
The podcast where you, the American voter, have the opportunity to understand how elections really work and how you can help improve the process and restore confidence in American democracy. We will interview leading election experts, explore election controversies, and demystify election administration, from voter registration to ballot casting and counting, results reporting, and on through to certification and audits. We'll answer all your burning questions. Is vote by mail safe? How are foreign countries trying to interfere in our elections? And yes, do dead people actually vote? And we hope you will listen, like the future of our country depends on it.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
Ladies and gentlemen, please remain standing for the singing of our national anthem.
Brexit means Brexit.
My administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country.
Hello and welcome. I'm Royfield Brown, who's in a rather wet, damp, grey, actually, dare I say, cold California. It feels like London. It is that grey and overcast. But today, we're going to try a new format on Mid-Atlantic, which is a thing which I'm dubbing The World This Week, where we're going to look at three, possibly four topics in the next hour. We don't have our regular pundit team with us today, which I think is a augurs well for having a different type of energy for this new format. And the format is, as I said, we're going to look at three or four different news topics which concern the world. And today we're going to start in France with the French election.
Tonight, a rematch runoff in the battle for the most powerful politician in France, current President Emmanuel Macron and far-right candidate Marine Le Pen. The two will face off on April 24th as a repeat of their 2017 election. Macron beat Le Pen 5 years ago in a landslide. But the world has changed, as has the political landscape in France. Macron, who rose to power as an outsider, a candidate pushing for reform from the center, has dealt with yellow vest protests opposing his policies, a refugee crisis, and a pandemic during his time in office. His approval rating underwater for most of his presidency. And as with the United States, extreme right-wing policies have gone more mainstream.
Ensemble, nous allons construire avec enthousiasme et conviction.
Le Pen is known for her far-right stances, like restricting immigration and banning Muslim women from wearing headscarves in public. She softened her image in an effort to appeal to a broader audience, though questions remain whether it's a true political shift or just a strategy.
Frank Lai in Berlin, I'm going to come to you. I must admit, I'm somewhat scared about the prospect of a President Le Pen. Thinking about potentially what this could do for Europe, this is going to completely derail the EU. Already she's talking about potentially France coming out of the command structure of NATO. This is going to be like Brexit and Trump all rolled into one. What's the view of the French election from Germany?
Well, I can't speak for Germany, but what I personally see is that Marine, her full name, Marion Anne-Perrine Le Pen, she went to president elections for three times already, and she didn't get the president of France, and I don't see her winning this time. Emmanuel Macron does a really great job, and from the German perspective, I think we are very delighted to have this man in France because he's great in communication, and even though there are nuances and maybe some differences in certain perspectives, France with Emmanuel Macron understands the value of the European Union and also the cooperation and the importance of the cooperation with Germany. And I think with the current events in Ukraine and with Russia, I think that Macron has an adequate posture that works for the EU, that works on the international floors, and that works for France. So raised his numbers. If you compare the last election and the current election, he rose his percentage by 1% right now. And I don't think that Marine Le Pen can hold anything against that. And if you've seen her posing with Putin, and even just before the war started, posing with a picture with Putin and Trump and her, so there's a painted picture with the three of them, and they are all looking to the right. So she's on this illiberal side, and I don't think that France, the liberal France, is anywhere close to being ready for her, or the other way around.
There's France being ready for it, and then potentially that there is Europe. We have Tina, you're based in Helsinki, and we have Irina. Irina, are you actually in Ukraine? Where exactly are you today, Irina?
Hi, I am actually in Vienna, in Austria. I'm originally from Ukraine.
Marine Le Pen has said that after this conflict, that that NATO needs close relations with Russia. She hasn't exactly been the staunchest ally of the Ukrainian people. She's also said that NATO and Western countries need to stop sending so many, in parentheses, weapons to Ukraine. What is your opinion about this potential French president?
I hope that she will lose. I mean, I'm sure that she will lose, hopefully. I was just sitting in the cafe here in Vienna, and there were two Russians sitting next to me on the table next to me. And they were saying, oh, hopefully Le Pen will win. Hopefully she will win. So that tells you everything.
And what was their reasoning for wanting Le Pen to win? Very obviously, she does have this close relationship with Putin. But what specifically, what specific rainbows and unicorns would then happen across Europe according to them, if Marine Le Pen was to become the president of France?
Well, I can only assume that they hope that France will leave NATO with her, and that she will be more supportive of Russia, I suppose. I mean, I didn't really follow too closely because I didn't take it seriously so much, but hopefully she will lose.
Piotr Curzon, you've joined us in the room. Give us a sense of how destabilizing, or not maybe, a Marine Le Pen presidency would mean for the European project.
Well, thank you, Royfield, for having me, and always great to have another great session in the Mid-Atlantic. It's very interesting because obviously Le Pen is seen as the far-right candidate, but she was, we must remember, not even the most far right. Eric Zemmour, who only won about 7% of the vote on Sunday, Monday, is you know, was seen as an even far righter candidate. And if anything, he took some votes away from Marine Le Pen, and that's why we see Mélenchon, the socialist candidate, so close to Le Pen. I think there was less than a percentage point in it. She's actually tried to move her party further, sort of, well, leftwards is perhaps a strong word, but more centralize it in the proper Republican-esque center right area. Now, there are certain issues that she's very still strongly righted, centered on, and that's right leaning on, which is immigration. But she has tried to, in recent weeks, distance herself from the more pro-Putin stance she had 5 years ago, saying, for example, that she fully agrees with the sanctions programs and that she would be open to sort of exploring ways to bolster European security. So she's tried to change her tune, but we must remember that she still does come from a background which is incredibly pretty far right in many ways. And I think it shows you the how disenfranchised members of the French electorate are, because the far left have made it very clear that at least the younger generations, that they're going to be voting for her in exit polls that I've seen. Even Mélenchon, who's a huge critique of Macron, has made it very critical to been very vocal that to his you know, supporters, don't vote for this woman, vote for Macron. He's establishment, but he's still less destructive and self-sabotaging for France and therefore the European project. Last point, Macron is the face of the European project, so to speak. He's been pushing for, you know, European defence and a greater strategical autonomy, and that was reflected in the Strategic Compass initiative that was launched under the Common Security and Defence Policy, or CSDP, last year, which is the overarching mechanism in the EU. So if he were to leave, you couldn't be talking further, like, divergence from Le Pen. Chalk and cheese sort of thing. So we could see, if Le Pen wins or if Macron stays, we could see a complete polar opposite approach to French security and therefore the European project and overall European stability and security against the Russians.
Tina, Finland is in the process of applying to become a member of NATO. Finland is a stalwart member of the European Union. Could you see the European Union starting to fray if Le Pen became the president of France?
Hey, thank you, Royfield. I follow carefully these elections because if you think about Marine Le Pen, he belongs to the same kind of coalition in European Union where you find, for example, Swedish Democrats and from Sweden, which is same kind of far right extremist group, and also True Finns. We call them True Finns, and I think it's very important to understand that the coalition is very important ecosystem of European Union. And of course, what we saw before elections, this so-called far-right coalition in European Union start to fall apart a little bit because of course, Marine Le Pen. I think she lose a lot of voters before the Russian invasion to Ukraine. And we have to remember Marine Le Pen also lent a lot of money before, I think it was several years ago, from Russian bank before being elected after his father, because his father was someone who actually founded the party. So your answer shortly, I think I agree with everybody else in this room that Marine Le Pen is not suitable at all for presidency. But I understand he reflects some of the voters' soul and of course, a feeling of not having voice or being dropped kind of out of society. It's the same kind of phenomenon what we have in Sweden and also in Finland. So those are countries I know, of course, well, because now living here. But I've been living also in Italy, and you can say Forza Italia is some kind of rhetoric. But let's say that Le Pen, Swedish Democrats, and true Finns are those kind of what we should be scared about it and worry about it.
So many people talk about this disenfranchised voice of people, which in part fueled Trump, in part fueled Brexit in the UK, and has given wind to right-wing populists and demagogues throughout Europe. What does he say about the economic situation that we find ourselves in the West, that so many countries are turning, if not wholesale, but in part, to right-wing rhetoric, that feel that this gives them some level of a solution?
There are quite a few exceptions to the baby bust crisis that Western Europe is facing. I mean, one of the easy solutions to that is immigration. I think France has had the most of it out of any EU nation as far as a percentage of their retirees, the people who are actively working and gaining skills and ultimately filling out the tax base. But I think for most of the EU, I know in the median boomer will be retired, and for the EU it's even worse because there isn't a millennial bulge in the population to support that kind of a tax base in retirement. So it might have been Greece and Spain and Italy, you know, after 08, but looks like it'll be the majority of Europe going forward if anything happens. And it's going to be pretty difficult to find the money anywhere with the level, with just the sheer amount of workers that they are going to need and the amount of workers that they're going to have.
Andrea, you unmuted.
Well, I was thinking about the impact. I was going to raise the issue of immigration, but I was also thinking about the economic impact of inflation and how that is at the moment ravaging the world. But I think in general, another point to note is also how much of it is rhetoric in spin as the right wing is trying to, you know, run and control a narrative that divides and, you know, splits people on immigration, insecurity, and identity. Because I think in general, the quality of life and living has been relatively stabled, and that part of this could be narrative, although I'm sure that there are many vulnerable populations as well in France. But I think there's an element of narrative from the right that needs to be examined further.
Well, we will see who will be the next president of France after Sunday, April the 24th, 2022.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Drama playing out in real time between Twitter and Elon Musk. CNBC correspondent Christina Partsenevelos is covering it all for us today. Christina, this Twitter saga that has been going on the last few days now has taken another turn this morning. Talk to us about what Elon Musk is doing and why.
He's, I guess, the gift that keeps on giving. He's also the richest man in the world, and he said he wants to take Twitter or buy 100% of Twitter and take it private. This after he became the largest shareholder earlier this month. What he is proposing is $54.20 in cash per share. Notice how he threw a 420 in there. He believes that he could, quote, unlock the potential of this company. Doesn't think management can do a good enough job. The Twitter board did say that they're going to be reviewing this short proposal. And then we just learned at CNBC just now that employees are having a meeting and a company-wide meeting at 5 p.m. later today about this information.
I don't massively care for this man. I quite like his cars. I quite like the fact that the world is moving to electric power. But other than that, he seems to be a little bit of a blowhard, somebody who really likes the sound of his own voice. But what does this mean for freedom of expression, as my American friends are always telling me? You know, the ability to speak freely in the public space. He's a free speech advocate. He's also somebody who massively commands our media attention. Should we care? Should we not care? Who wants to talk first about Elon Musk potentially buying Twitter?
I think we should care because it's, you know, still a... Twitter is an unprecedented source of information, be it providing it or exchanging it. And, you know, put it into context... and the access to information in the areas of like open source intelligence gathering, image sharing, updates. It's very, very quick. And you get some good analysis from some, you know, respected people. For example, Dmitry Alpovich, Michael Kaufman, Ian Bremmer, people in the known geopolitical military areas. So it's very useful. But the thing that changed it was the audio. The function that we're using to have this podcast right now, Clubhouse and Twitter Spaces, I found myself being able to express myself very coherently and effectively on Twitter Spaces. So, you know, I think it's a good platform. And therefore, if someone wants to buy the whole thing and privatize the company, we should care about it. Should we be obsessed with it? No, I don't give two shits. Excuse my French. What Elon Musk is really doing. I think that he's doing a lot of good things for the planet in the sense of space exploration and Tesla. But I often think he enjoys being the drama queen or whatever it is. And frankly, maybe it's just my Britishness, but I've never really been interested in the pop culture obsession of celebrities. So care? No. Yes. Obsess? No. No. But, you know, pay attention, because what could this mean for other companies and how we facilitate information sharing and whether or not he will change it grossly. And also just for the freedom of speech as a symbol, I think it is important in a time when we're more polarized and overwhelmed.
Why is this man so beloved by a certain section of American society? And I'll put it very clearly, as these seem to be young men who are living in their mother's basement. They seem to think this man is the second coming. Why does he command such affection and such loyalty? And why does he chop so much media space? Anybody feel free to jump in.
I think a big one is that he has a lot of the appeal that Donald Trump had as far as taking a stance that is offensive to the sacred cows of the establishment. He is an anti-boomer figure, and that appeals broadly to a lot of young people in America as far as where the culture ought to be shifting toward, rather than preserving this television entertainment politics and level university studies kind of not British, not Anglican, but easily a much more prudish society than what Elon Musk would operate. He named his car model sexy. He sells a flamethrower that you shouldn't buy. He buys things for 420. He smokes weed on the Joe Rogan Experience. All things that piss off just the right kind of people that other people would like to hurt.
In the room chat, good friend of the podcast, AB, said Elon Musk wanting to buy Twitter has got nothing to do with unlocking Twitter's potential and everything to do with being able to control the flow and access of information that Twitter provides. Anybody care to wildly, violently, polemically disagree with that? Because I must admit, as much as I care not really for this story, I kind of lean more slightly towards that interpretation as the reason why Elon Musk has bought 9% of Twitter, but wants to buy the rest of it.
The state of Twitter now. Twitter is affecting the information that people receive. Twitter is affecting culture, the way the country is operating, the way people are behaving at work. And so if there's going to be a battle of it, and it's going to go, the flow is going to be directed towards the person who's the highest bidder, I think we've all selected with our pocketbooks who's going to be capable of controlling that information.
Andrea, you unmuted.
I just had one further observation on Elon Musk, which is I think it remains to be seen, you know, what he does with, you know, with this stake. I think it is very interesting, especially for those of us on these types of social audio platforms as well, where moderation is key, you know, to see. I find it interesting that in all the news coverage on this, very little has been, light has been shed on some of the harms from these types of social media platforms, the complete, total, unfettered public square, or, you know, which is meant to be good for free speech and certainly uplifts, and we can hear, you know, what people around the world are thinking without censorship. But then there is evidence and there are studies showed where sometimes that can devolve into, you know, harassment, both on the platform and off, possibly reckless statements and, you know, maybe. So I think it's going to be very interesting. And misinformation, excuse me, and disinformation, which has been very detrimental, actually, to democracy as a whole, as we are learning, and not just democracy, but health and COVID and other issues. So it's going to be very interesting to see what he does with his stake and share in the platform in terms of his motivation. I think if he uses it to somehow block, to privatize it or somehow block people that, you know, dissent with his views or would stand up against him, then obviously he'd be undermining his whole argument about the need to keep speech completely free and unfettered.
Well, that's an excellent point. And I'm just going to read out one of the messages in the chat, which is from AB, a good friend of the podcast. And he says, particularly with the many criticisms Elon gets about his business venture, buying Twitter would essentially allow him to censor any criticisms and critics from speaking out about anything he or those in his circle are involved in. And he, if you remember back, he did accuse what the, let me get this right now, I'm doing this from memory. There was the cave in Thailand about 3 years ago where the school kids were trapped and somebody went in and rescued them and he accused that person of being a paedophile. And he used Twitter to amplify this claim. And this person, you know, and it was the most egregious thing to say to somebody who was actually going to rescue people. If he owns Twitter, you know, it does feel very, very odd if I'm forced to really sit down and think about this, because I did dismiss this too readily beforehand, that somebody who is the richest man in the world or one of the richest men in the world has also got his hands completely on this mouthpiece, and he has used it recklessly in the past. Anybody care to comment?
Honestly, like to comment.
Okay, go for it.
Oh, yeah, I guess two things here. Andrea had mentioned issues about misinformation or the abuse of social media and that causing broader problems with society. Royfield, you just mentioned Elon Musk saying reckless things on Twitter that, you know, I guess ruffle feathers. I think can't remember if he got a fine from the SEC for tweeting. He definitely got in some trouble tweeting about a potential buyout for Tesla and having secured a stock price and whatnot, and that was violated some rules. But in general, I mean, it seems like one of his motivations is being upset with censorship in general. I, for one, strongly support, you know, any moves to, you know, remove censorship, remove like the centralization of control of information flows on the internet. Like the original promise of the internet was that anybody is supposed to be able to talk to anybody. That's designed in a way that it's supposed to be able to withstand a nuclear war. And, you know, it would reroute your packets anywhere it needed to go in order to reach its final destination. And it was users who just gave up control to these big platforms to decide, oh yeah, you can filter all my information through this. It's easy to see, you know, cat photos of my friends and to hit like, and, you know, there's a snazzy interface for that. And most people didn't demand accountability and flexibility and decentralization, all the things that really like the internet was originally designed for and had a lot of promise for. So there was a big regression that happened. I would mark it with the advent of Facebook in the mid 2000s. And I think now people are talking about Web3 and things like that. And I think we're slowly giving birth to a new era of decentralization and lack of censorship and lack of centralized control. And I think Elon Musk sees some potential to, okay, how can we take the old, you know, and revivify it, remove these ridiculous constraints to some degree, still keeping some of it, obviously. But, you know, I applaud him for his, you know, however it works out. I just think, even if it's a massive troll, I applaud him even more. And I think it's great that he tweets like random, weird, sounds like he's on psychedelic things at 3 a.m. while he's running two of the largest companies in the world. I just applaud him. He has every right to do so. He's earned the right to do so. So those are my thoughts. Thank you.
Well, I'll tell you, nothing says decentralization than one guy owning 100% of one of the largest social media companies in the world, right?
That was my thoughts entirely. If you're listening to this at home, why don't you download the Clubhouse app for your phone? And what it means is that then you can be part of one of the live recordings of the show. When they go out, then you can be alerted by joining the Mid-Atlantic Club. If you're in the audience, hit the Mid-Atlantic icon, the little greenhouse, top right, top left on your phone, and then you'll be alerted as when we go live. I'm going to move on from Elon Musk, and I'm going to go now to the Black Sea.
Welcome to the program. It's 50 days today since Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the start of the war there. And Ukraine is claiming to have carried out a missile attack on the flagship of Russia's Black Sea fleet, setting it on fire. The Russians admit the Moskva has been badly damaged, but they say it was because ammunition on board exploded.
Quoting the Russian Defense Ministry, Interfax says the crew of around 500 had all been evacuated and the cause of the fire being investigated. But a Ukrainian official has said the ship had been hit by two missiles. However, this has not been confirmed. The Moskva is the pride of the Russian naval fleet in the Black Sea. Russia's activities there are crucial to supporting land operations in the south of Ukraine, where Russia is battling to seize full control of the port of Mariupol. There are very different narratives in Russia and Ukraine about what happened with the Moskva cruiser.
Since I clipped that up from the BBC, we now know that the Moskva has actually sunk. This is yet another sign as to how disastrously the Russian campaign is going with its attempt to occupy Ukraine. The Ukrainians are fighting back valiantly, not just on land, but now also on sea. And this is the second Russian naval bit of material that have actually sunk during the war. I'm going to come to you first, Pyotr, but I really want to widen this out. So obviously, this is shown us the military prowess of the Ukrainians. I also want us to look at what this means in terms of the continued escalation of the war. So Pyotr Kurzon, the Moskva has been sunk. And I think what's significant was that the news of this actually came from Russian wires.
Well, Royfield, this is a turning point, I think. I mean, you can point to a few, not just symbolic, but remarkable moments or notable moments where there was perhaps one phase was ending and another phase begun, or there was a tide turning, so to speak, a bit of a sea change, as English punditries like to say. So when we first heard that the ship had been hit or had these issues, you know, I was sitting on the fence. Is it really the Russians or is it the Ukrainians? The Ukrainians have these recently acquired Neptune missiles, their first batch coming as early, late as last year. And these are the ones that they said were had been used to strike the ship. Now, the Russians claimed that this wasn't true. Naturally, and they said that this was actually due to an internal sort of breakage of electronics and an ammunition's failure, which, if was the case, would reflect a almost tit for tat version that we saw on the land about 2.5 weeks ago. You know, in Volgograd, one of the nearby Russian settlements of Ukraine, there was a blast of. And people weren't able to tell whether it was the Russians who'd mishandled the munitions or whether the Ukrainians had struck them with some missiles. So the same seems to be apparent here. But what seems to have happened is that either way, the Russians were actually telling the truth in that the ship was damaged and now it's sunk due to rocky waters. So should we perhaps believe them about a couple of other things? If they're willing to admit this, their flagship vessel of the Black Sea fleet being sunk, then perhaps they are being honest about a couple of other things as well, in the sense of mishandles and just poor military craftsmanship, so to speak. So that's something that's interesting to keep in mind, and I'll be monitoring myself. But in the broader picture, I mean, look, the vessel was valued at about $750 million. By far the most important vessel of the Black Sea fleet, not the most powerful all and out, but it was, you know, it was getting on. It's about 40 years old since it was first launched, and but it was very useful and had led a very important set of campaigns in the earlier part of this conflict. And to the final point I'll make in terms of looking ahead, I mean, this could be significant for just how far and capable the Russians believe they can be. Name specifically meaning that up until this point, we're waiting for this Russian advancement offensive to occur on the eastern flank of Ukraine, enter into the Donbass region and take not just Luhansk, but Donetsk. And then there were other people, including myself, that if that went quite swimmingly, then maybe the Russians would push once they reached the south coast westwards, try and secure the whole Sea of Azov, the body of water rightwards of Crimea, and then push as far west as they could, perhaps to Kherson. Now, this, if they wanted to do that, that would require significant naval support, because the Ukrainians are increasingly well positioned down there, especially around the Dnieper River and Kherson. So if they've lost their primary battle cruiser, is that going to make the Russian military consider?
we finally have a clear-cut general at the top now who was leading in Syria. So maybe he's going to be looking at this and thinking, well, we may have to reevaluate just how far we can push our phase two of the campaign. So it's definitely going to be some discussions, I think, going on in the inner military circles of the Kremlin and whatnot about what to do in the light of these events.
Andrea, I kind of said in my kind of preamble to this section that for me, one of the surprising things or significant things is the fact that this news that the Moskva had been sunk was confirmed by the Russians first. Does this kind of hint at maybe a change in policy that the Russians are going to be much more open about their losses? Or is this just somewhat of a quirk? Should we not read too much into it? What do you reckon?
Based on pure opinion only, I did think that that was very interesting that it was claimed or even by a Moscow-based think tank. First, but the Center for Analysis of Strategies and Technologies, which they said on a Telegram channel. I thought that that was fascinating. And I wouldn't read too much. I would say that we have to wait and see, unless they are wanting to drum up support at home and reinforce, the need to continue to fight this war and get some sympathy for the war by, sharing some of their losses. But I think more than likely, I would keep my eye on it. My feeling is that it was a quirk and one that we should continue to keep our eye
on. It's interesting because I viewed it slightly the other way, that potentially this is a loosening of Kremlin censorship and or the media asserting independence. That's the way that I kind of read it. But we can slightly widen this out slightly. Irina, you're Ukrainian. You now find yourself in Austria. Are you able to keep in contact with friends and family? And if so, how are you doing that and how are they?
Well, yeah, I keep in touch with, first of all, my mom moved to the western Ukraine, western part of Ukraine from Kiev, but most of my family didn't want to leave, so they are still there, and we keep in touch by phone. And I also speak with a lot of people here on Clubhouse all the time from Ukraine, so yeah, you can ask me questions, I don't know what you're interested in, but I keep in touch with Ukrainians all the time.
And how is their morale, the people that you do keep in contact with? I had a really interesting conversation on Clubhouse with an American embedded journalist who's actually in Odessa, who was actually saying that life in Odessa in the last week or so has sprung back, that bars and cafes are still open. That is very obviously not the case in the East, which is, if not under Russian occupation, it's still very close to where the front line truly is. So just give us a sense of your family, without going into too many specifics, were they displaced? Are they getting daily air raid warnings, etc.? But, without too many specifics, just give us some kind of picture. Thank you, Irina.
Sure. So they are not displaced. I mean, a little bit displaced, let's put it this way, a little bit displaced. Some of my relatives are actually in the defense, how do you call it, like troops, not the army, but regional troops. What is interesting is that so many people are going back to Kyiv, that there are huge traffic jams on the way to Kyiv, and the mayor said, don't come back. For a few days, a few weeks, because it's logistically difficult. The morale is extremely good, extremely, strong and confident. I'm not talking about the eastern and southern part, though I talked with some people from the east and they're also very confident and strong and united and also don't want to leave, even in the south of Ukraine. I cannot speak about, places like Mariupol and Lugansk and Donetsk. It's different. Yeah, so I think that, yeah, and in the central part of Ukraine and even in some western part, they still hear the air raids and the sirens. So it's a little bit strange. I didn't think that in the central Ukraine and in the western part there would be air raids, but probably there are. So that's the situation. Thank you.
Thank you, Irina. Tina, I want to come to you. Sweden and Finland are formally starting the process to join NATO. And this is obviously both countries feel that they've been pushed into this position by Russia's bellicose actions in Ukraine. The response of Putin in terms of Finland and Sweden wanting to join, I think it's been somewhat kind of comical. It's a case of, you're going to do this, so I'm going to threaten you, which actually reinforces the whole point of actually wanting to join NATO. I know we spoke about this before in a previous room, but could you give us some sense of the political debate which has been happening in Finland regarding joining NATO? And how threatened did Finns actually feel by those pictures a few days ago of Russia moving rocket launchers closer to the Finnish border? Was that truly something which people said, well, there you go, we now need to join NATO? Was it a case of this is a bit of an eye roll, this is kind of posturing?
Yes, I thank you for asking me that. Yes, this debate has been going on for several weeks. And of course, what happened just yesterday was the government of Finland release so-called framework of new national security situation, where actually government just analyze whether Finland should applying for NATO or not. And I think we've been seeing a lot of threats during decades, because as far as I remember, it's not the first time when Russian is using hard rhetoric. But of course, during these days and during these weeks, there is a lot of I can call it also propaganda, because I think Russia knows pretty well how to move certain individuals to spread information which sounds someone else ears much more harder than is it. And we just read about ex-president Medvedev, who actually gave I think he was interviewed by European journalist, and he told precisely that Finland and Sweden will have some consequences. And if you look at Finland's politicians, what they say afterwards, they say this is very typical info war, what we've been having during this time, because it's not only the speak persons who gives interview during the time when we are thinking to apply into NATO, but we also have a violation of the airspace just last week, and we've been having also cyber attacks to the government websites, and it lasts several hours, and also for our biggest banks. So I think Russian is very good to organize any kind of so-called hybrid influencing, and we should not take or concentrating too much on it. But of course, situation is totally different than 1 month ago, and everybody say that, not only me and people who are living in my country, but all the politicians and war experts and leaders, and of course everybody who knows how Russia changed during the 10 years. There's no free media anymore, and there's so much violations of human rights. So it's a country you cannot trust anymore. So this is Tina Amdan speaking.
Thank you for that, Tina. Frank Lai, last point, putting a pointed question to you, then I'm going to kind of open this out because I know we have a few more people on stage. There's been a little bit of a spat between Ukraine and Germany, Ukraine being very upset about Germany's kind of pre-invasion stance vis-a-vis Russia and energy supplies. Your president wanted to go there. The Ukrainians said no a few days ago. Was this a big deal in the German media?
Yes, it is the president of Germany. And he has just been re-elected. And he is a reputable politician. He has a so he has some reputation. And on the other side, and this is really some. I think that we have to be very cautious because this invasion by Russia is way bigger than any particular person or politician. But so in Germany, it is generally understood why Zelensky has to act in certain ways, and that is presented throughout the media. So it is generally understood why he is acting in the way he does, and it is also understood that if you look at the history of Steinmeier having his photos with Putin, that he personally doesn't want to invite Steinmeier to the Ukraine, given that the support that he needs to defend Ukraine right now isn't met up from the German side as he would wish to. But the situation is very complex. I think that Germany does a lot of things, and we have to acknowledge the situations that the countries are in. And we also need to keep a focus on how to affect Putin and his circles and the oligarchs, and not hurt certain populations more than those circles. And all of these things are in a very complex manner connected. It is presented, it is discussed, and it is not taken lightly, and it's also not taken into a binary. But there is a disappointment, I think, for the president himself, and for the German representative side in general. I mean, this is the German president, and it is not just the person. I hope that answers the question.
It absolutely does, and thank you for that, Frank. Aaron, you have a great opportunity here to be able to wrap things up for us in terms of, we started off talking about the French election with Marine Le Pen potentially having the opportunity to become the next president of France and what it will do to Europe. We're now talking about the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Give us some idea of some of the geopolitical fallout that a Le Pen presidency would mean immediately to the conflict in Ukraine.
A couple of things there. I mean, so Marine Le Pen, very much a nationalist, and so because of that, largely seen as anti-intergovernmental treaty. She has not been, she hasn't had great things to say about NATO or the EU. And the other thing is that she's found a bit of a friend in Putin, actually. Soon after the annexation of Crimea, she made statements saying that it was perfectly legitimately legal for Putin to have done what he did.
there with Crimea thing. I mean, one of the reasons why the sanctions and the ostracization, of the Russian government there has been so successful is because everyone's kind of doing it at the same time, right? Not everybody equally, of course, right? We still have Turkey taking Russian money and resources there and paying for that. We have Germany still buying Russian oil. Generally speaking, the campaign has been successful because everyone's kind of on the same page. France's position in NATO and the EU is quite substantial. And so if France goes in a particular direction, other places will as well. We understand it also in terms of the EU that Viktor Orban is also pretty friendly, Putin as well. It'll actually be interesting because one of the things that I forecast is that typically in EU deliberations, right, you've had Poland and Hungary kind of, you know, being lockstep in terms of, how do I put this diplomatically?
Being Eurosceptics.
sure. <that's...
laughs> outliers to the liberal European project.
Yeah, thank you, Rocco. Appreciate that there. Exactly. And so it's been interesting because with the invasion, Poland certainly doesn't have any time for Putin's bullshit, but Viktor Orban does. And so there's been a bit of a schism, to put it lightly, in the sort of small alliance that Hungary and Poland had ideologically. What I think that can happen if Marine Le Pen does win is that she will kind of take the place of Poland's peace party there to be the ideological teammate there for Viktor Orban. I'm not sure that France is really helping the Ukrainian army there that much. So I'm not sure how much of a difference it will make for this particular thing in the near term. However, I think that definitely we could see arguments for diminishing NATO support, perhaps, that Le Pen could certainly argue in favor of.
Yeah, you're completely right. We have had this conversation before, and the one thing which has scared all Eurosceptics from that position is the mess that us Brits made of Brexit. You were the staunchest Front National member, and I'm calling them the National Front of France because that's what they are. They've just put a new lick of paint. Or you were part of the League in Italy, and you talked about exiting European Union, and it's been an utter nightmare when you looked at what's happened in Britain. So nobody wants to do that. But you can strategically roll back, though, can't you? You can say things like, we're going to put in laws which are illiberal, just like what the Hungarians have and the Poles have. So all of a sudden, there is much more restrictions around abortion, LGBTQ rights, etc. You can say that we are going to not
immigration
so much money. Also immigration. We're also going to not put so much money into the European pot. You can slow the works down, can't you? You can argue against balance of transfer payments to the poorer bits of Europe, etc., etc. So there are many things which you can do while still being part of the European structure just to gum the works up. And there you go, folks. That's been the very first The World this week. This is part of the podcast Mid-Atlantic. Mid-Atlantic you can find by going to a podcatcher of your choice. You'll go and find hundreds of these shows. Been doing them for some 8 years now. Speaking to experts, pundits, sometimes just my friends, sometimes even family members about politics, generally from a US and a UK perspective, but sometimes from a broader perspective. We'll do this once a week, every Thursday, round about this time, where we'll have 3 or 4 new stories, and we'll try and unpack them and then unpack them in an hour. That's been me, Royfield Brown, speaking to Tina, Frank, Irina, Andrea, Aaron, Agent, Piotr, and a few others besides. Give the Mid-Atlantic Club a follow, please. Give people on the stage a follow if you're in the audience, because they're all good people. They've come up on stage and they've shared their views and I've told you what they thought of the world this week. Take care. Look after yourselves. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts?
Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.